audio-described winner for Best Picture, 1935's Mutiny on the Bounty, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. And next week, listen for our selection for Best Picture from the 1940s.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 45 and clear. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the low 60s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the mid-40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 a.m.
Welcome to this week's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American Religion sections and Sunday School lessons read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, February 20th, 2021. Religion. Survey reports Black Americans attend church and pray more often. From the Associated Press. New York. Black Americans attend church more regularly than Americans overall and pray more often. Most attend churches that are predominantly black, yet many would like those congregations to become racially diverse. There is broad respect for black churches' historical role in seeking racial equality, coupled with a widespread perception they have lost influence in recent decades. Those are among the key findings in a comprehensive report released Tuesday by the Pew Research Center, which surveyed 8,660 black adults across the United States about their religious experiences. It is Pew's first large-scale survey on the topic. Among black adults who go to religious services, 60% attend churches where the senior clergy and most or all of the congregation are black, Pew found. It said 25% are part of multiracial congregations, and 13% are part of congregations that are predominantly white or another ethnicity. Pew said patterns of worship are shifting across generations. Younger black adults born since 1980 attend church less often than their elders, and those who attend are less likely to do so in a predominantly black congregation. Among 30 black pastors and religious leaders interviewed by Pew, some predicted further shrinkage of predominantly black churches and an increase in multiracial congregations. I don't think there should be a black church, said Dr. Clyde Posley Jr. of Antioch Baptist Church in Indianapolis. There isn't a black heaven and a white heaven. A proper church will one day eschew the label of black church and be a universal church. The survey found that 66% of black Americans are Protestant, 6% are Catholic, and 3% identify with other Christian faiths, mostly Jehovah's Witnesses. Another 3% belong to Islam or other non-Christian faiths. Some 21% are not affiliated with any religion and instead identify as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. Black Americans born since 1980 are far more likely to be among the unaffiliated. Survey responses were collected from November 2019 through June 2020, but most respondents completed the survey by February 10th, 2020, before the coronavirus outbreak and the racial injustice protests that spread after the death of George Floyd in May at the hands of Minneapolis police. Among the respondents, 77% said predominantly black churches had played a role in helping black people move toward racial equality, yet just one-third said historically black congregations should preserve their traditional character. 61% said those congregations should become more racially diverse. Nearly half of respondents said black churches are less influential today than 50 years ago. Among the clergy interviewed by Pew, some said too few black pastors have been on the front lines of recent struggles against racism. When you look at Black Lives Matter, this is the first time that there has been any political uprising, and the church isn't spearheading it, said the Reverend Harvey L. Vaughn III, senior pastor of Bethel AME Church in San Diego. We're not as bold and courageous as we used to be, said the Reverend Sandra Reed of St. Mark AME Zion Church in Newtown, Pennsylvania. I have to say, I'm somewhat ashamed of that, because the AME Zion Church is known as the Freedom Church that was at the forefront of addressing all the ills of America, and we sort of lost that. The survey indicates that congregants at Black Protestant churches are more likely to hear preaching about race relations and criminal justice reform than those attending multiracial or white churches. Black Protestants, meanwhile, are less likely than U.S. Protestants overall to hear sermons on abortion. Pew found 68% of Black adults said abortion should be allowed in most or all cases, compared with 59% of all U.S. adults. Pew also posed some survey questions to 4,574 Americans who do not identify as Black to provide comparisons. Asked whether religion is very important in their lives, 59% of Black respondents said yes, next to 40% of all U.S. adults. Asked if they prayed daily, 63% of Black respondents said yes, compared with 44% overall. According to a recent national study cited by Pew, women make up only 16% of religious leaders at Black Protestant churches. Pew's survey found that 85% of respondents favored allowing women to serve as senior leaders of congregations, however. Pew said the survey's margin of error for the full number of respondents was plus or minus 1.5 percentage points. Black pastors and worshipers in predominantly white or multiracial denominations face a number of contemporary race-related issues. Some Black pastors have left the predominantly white Southern Baptist Convention in dismay over decisions by white leaders that they view as downplaying the problem of systemic racism. In the Episcopal Church and some other mainline Protestant denominations, there are reparations initiatives aimed at making amends for past involvement in slavery and the mistreatment of Black and Indigenous people. And many Black Catholics have urged leaders of their church to be more forceful in combating racism. Some have asked the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops to consider reparations and promote the teaching of Black Catholic history in Catholic schools. We still don't have the church taking a necessary stand against systemic racism, Tia Noel Pratt, a sociologist who has studied racism in the U.S. Catholic Church and an advisor on Pew's survey, told the Associated Press via email. This means acknowledging the white supremacy that exists in the church and ways white church leaders and white members of the faithful benefit from it. The Reverend Mario Powell, a Black priest who heads a Jesuit middle school in Brooklyn, said Catholic clergy need to preach more often against racism and speak out against some of their colleagues who brazenly post white nationalist ideology online. White leads Monahan's Church. New Mexico native changed careers in midlife, by Bob Campbell. The Reverend Stephen Steve White was a computer scientist for many years for IBM and Microsoft, and now as pastor of the First United Methodist Church in Monahans, he wants to guide people away from the disturbing headlines of the day to the timeless lessons of the Bible. I like to preach from the Gospels and be as close as possible to the direct teachings of Jesus, White said. Then we go through the end of Genesis with Jacob running away from his brother, wrestling with God and having his name changed to Israel, which means you have striven with men and God. That's powerful because it describes where we all are. White is a 59-year-old native of Quemado in west central New Mexico who attended Austin College at Sherman and graduated from New Mexico State in Las Cruces and Claremont School of Theology in Claremont, California. He served churches in La Mesa, New Mexico, El Paso, and Quanah before arriving here last summer. He speaks fluent Spanish. He and his wife, Teresa, have two children and a grandchild. We need to relate to current events and at times to great tragedy like 9/11 or the shootings at churches, but it must be based on the Bible, White said. It goes all the way back to the early church with the disciples, Paul, Peter, and Stephen. Teaching from sources other than the Bible, to me, is not preaching. White's 11 a.m. Sunday services are attended by an average of 12 to 15 people. Longtime First UMC member Guy Manise said the pastor had been disheartened by the pandemics forcing him to cancel services, especially the Advent and Christmas services. But Neese said the White and his wife have nonetheless endeared themselves to the church. Steve is a good preacher, she said. He has a great way of reaching out to everyone. He started doing a children's sermon, and the children love it when he sits on the stage and tells them a story about Jesus. He has a really good heart. You can tell how much he cares about people. He is good about reading scripture from the Old and New Testaments and teaching about Jesus' parables. Kathy Jewell, who was a member of St. Paul's United Methodist Church in El Paso when White was there, said he is funny and witty and he has a passion to serve God. Steve's evangelism and social concern are outstanding, Jewell said. He and Teresa painted walls and cleaned floors, and they helped when the first wave of immigrants arrived here from Mexico in 2014. He lives the Bible, and his message and his actions are the message. His call is a beautiful call, and I am so proud of him. Behind the Gender Difference of Non-Religious Americans by Ryan Burge from The Conversation. One of the most consequential stories in American religion in recent years is the rapid and seemingly unceasing rise of nuns, those who respond to questions about their religious affiliation by indicating that they are atheists, agnostics, or nothing in particular. According to some recent estimates, around 4 in 10 millennials and members of Gen Z, a group that comprises those born after 1980, do not identify with a religious tradition. In comparison, only about a quarter of baby boomers indicate that they are religiously unaffiliated. Social scientists are only beginning to explore the demographic factors that drive individuals who no longer feel attached to a religious tradition. But as someone who follows the data on religious trends, I note one factor appears to stand out: gender. Scholars have long noted that atheism skews male. Meanwhile, critics have pointed toward the apparent dominance of male authors in the new atheism movement as evidence of a boys' club. Indeed, a quick scan of the best-selling books on atheism on Amazon indicates that almost all of them are written by male authors. According to data from the Nationscape survey, which polled over 6,000 respondents every week for 18 months in the run-up to the 2020 election, men are in general more likely than women to describe themselves as atheists, agnostics, or nothing in particular. The survey, conducted by the Independent Democracy Fund in partnership with the University of California, Los Angeles, was touted as one of the largest such opinion polls ever conducted. However, tracking the gender gap by age reveals that at one point the gap between men and women narrows. Between the ages of 30 and 45, men are no more likely to be religiously unaffiliated than women of the same age. But the gap appears again among older Americans. Over the age of 60, men are 5 to 8 percentage points more likely to express no religious affiliation. Moreover, older Americans, both men and women, tend to be far less likely to identify as nuns as compared with younger Americans, according to the respondents of the survey. The life cycle effect. What may be driving this pattern of young women and older women being less likely to identify as nuns than their male counterparts? One theory in social science called the life cycle effect argues that when people begin to marry and have children, some are drawn back into religious circles to raise their kids in a religious environment or to lean on support structures that religion may provide. But once kids grow up and leave the house, this attachment fades for many. I make this point in my forthcoming book called The Nuns. The data on gender and those with no religious affiliation could indicate that this drifting is especially acute for men. One explanation could be that men are more likely to be religious when they are part of a family unit, but when children grow up, that connection becomes weaker. Unfortunately, the survey does not offer a direct test of this hypothesis, but it would fit with survey research over the past five decades that has consistently found that Christian women are more likely than men to attend church. One word of caution about the data is necessary. The survey is just a single snapshot of the public in 2019 and 2020. It's possible that this same pattern would look different if data were collected 20 years ago or 20 years from now. Either way, it offers a small window into how age and gender interact with the religious lives of Americans. The Conversation is an independent and nonprofit source of news, analysis, and commentary from academic experts. Push Yourself by Reverend John Carlo Villatoro, founding pastor of Victory Church, Odessa. I know it is not fun. Unfortunately, it is the only way you will accomplish things in life. If you are a student and you don't push yourself to do the homework and study for the tests, you are not going to pass the class. Therefore, you will not pass the semester. Then you will end up losing. When your supervisor is giving you a project, you know very well that you have to take care of that project. You have to review what are all the elements, the materials that you need to work with, and the people that you will be involved with. All that requires a lot of organization. Basically, you are talking about a lot of work. That is precisely the reason why only if you push yourself, you will succeed in life. If you have a business, you are financially independent. You handle your own schedule. You must push yourself even more than in any other situation. You need to be the one making sure the doors are open, phone calls are being answered, emails are being responded to. Ultimately, you are the one responsible for all the customer service activities. There is not one thing in life that doesn't require effort. Absolutely everything. It doesn't matter if you are working within a white-collar or blue-collar environment, whether you are involved in politics, sports, business, education, arts, entertainment, federal or city work, housewife, farmer, scientist, musician, attorney, or working from home online. It doesn't matter. Any activity and all activities need people to do their job. When they don't do the job, they don't get paid. All of us get paid one way or another. Sometimes it is money, but not always. There is a reward when you do your job. You will receive a reward when you do your part. The important thing is that you see the relevance of your contribution to your household or work environment. Keep pushing yourself because you know you can give more. You know very well that if you don't push yourself, you are not going to even take a shower or brush your teeth. Push yourself to be healthy, mentally and physically. Push yourself to overcome difficulties in your home and also in your work arena. Do not give up. God is with everyone who needs help. The Lord created you to give and give and give and give. Push yourself. Don't treat yourself like you are an invalid person. Don't see yourself like you are not smart enough or strong enough to do what you need to do. Don't compare yourself with others. You have an assignment in life. You have responsibilities in your home. You have a calling from God. Do it. Push yourself. So when you finish your tasks of the day, you can then rest and enjoy your evening. Rush Limbaugh gave his life to Jesus Christ a few years ago, and it gave him tremendous hope as he faced his toughest fight. So successful professionally, Rush also faced some dark times personally, but when I went to visit him last year, I was profoundly encouraged by the faith I found. Here's the story the rest of the media won't tell you, by Joel C. Rosenberg. Jerusalem. How did Rush Limbaugh become the most listened to and most influential radio broadcaster in American history? A brilliant conversationalist, absolutely the most original thinker on the American political and cultural scene, a cover story, a lightning rod, never boring, ever, and usually side-splittingly funny. Heard on more than 600 stations across the country. Listened to by more than 20 million people a week. Almost single-handedly rescued the dying AM radio system, turning it into a flourishing business through the political talk show format. Courted by Republican presidents and countless more presidential contenders. Credited by Ronald Reagan as the voice of conservatism. Credited by Newt Gingrich as helping conservatives win control of Congress in 1994 for the first time in 40 years. Most pro-Israel broadcaster in U.S. history. Hated by the left. Viciously and routinely attacked by Democrats and their allies in the media. Making $85 million a year. And ultimately, awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom at last year's State of the Union address. How did it all come about? The Rush I knew had a simple answer. Talent on loan from God, he loved to say. It wasn't just a throwaway line. It was true, but now God has taken him home. For the last several days, I have been mourning Rush's death, but not without hope. He was only 70. Death came too fast, took him too soon as far as I'm concerned. Yet there is something important and exciting that you should know about Rush. Rather late in his life, in his final few years, Rush gave his life fully and completely to Jesus Christ. Though he had been raised in a Christian family, this was different. Something specific had happened in his life. He had made a very personal and profound decision, and it changed everything. The mainstream media, so filled with hatred for Rush, will never tell you this side of him. So perhaps you'll let me. I had the rare opportunity to see Rush's extraordinary God-given talent firsthand. He interviewed me for a job in late 1993. And hired me in early 1994. For the next 2 years, I was blessed to work for him as research director and writer for the Limbaugh Letter, and working with him on various articles and op-eds he wrote for other publications. I also had the joy of working closely with his amazing, brilliant, fearless, and loyal inner circle, each of whom loved him dearly and continued working with him over the next several years. Literally to the end of his life. Some people spend a fortune to get a graduate degree in political science or communications. I didn't. I learned more about the art of media strategy, the process of discovering, developing, and driving a message from watching and working with Rush and his beloved team than I could have possibly learned anywhere else. And they paid me. But I will be honest. I worried about Rush over the years. He had multiple marriages that failed and left him hurt until his wonderful union to Catherine that brought him great joy. He battled with drug addiction to painkillers, and had to do it in the glare of the public eye. He lost his hearing, and but for the miracle of his cochlear implant, would have lost his entire career. On air, he certainly made his share of mistakes, often went right up to the line, occasionally went over. But those things were symptoms. At his core, he was struggling with something deeper. Raised in a wonderful Christian family in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, the heart of the American Midwest, he was steeped in Judeo-Christian values. But from my vantage point, and I wasn't nearly as close to him as everybody else on his team, nor am I claiming to have been, I believe he was struggling spiritually. His younger brother David became a very devout follower of Jesus Christ in the 1990s. Indeed, David, a lawyer by training and profession, has gone on to write some amazing books about the Christian faith, apologetics, and the persecution of Christians. But I worried that Rush was resisting a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, or perhaps too busy and too successful to focus on such a relationship. He and I occasionally discussed matters of faith, mine and his. But again, to be perfectly honest, he was intimidating to me. Not because he was mean or callous or uncaring, not at all. Rush was incredibly kind and generous, not just to people in general, but to me and my family. In the fall of 2002, he single-handedly turned my first political thriller into a number one bestseller and drove it onto the New York Times bestseller list for 11 straight weeks. How? He read it, loved it, and broke all of his personal rules about not interviewing people on his program who were not the President of the United States or Speaker of the House. That's right. He actually interviewed me and raved about my novel on air. I was absolutely stunned. And it wasn't just that one time. Many times over the years he would read and then enthusiastically endorse my books on his program. This simply was not done in his world. He didn't interview staff on air. He certainly didn't interview staff for the very monthly newsletter that a staffer once worked for. Yet he did it for me. And I loved him for this, and so many other reasons. That's why I worried about him, and a specific Bible verse kept echoing in my heart. Jesus once said, "What profits a man to gain the whole world, but to lose his soul?" That's what I feared for Rush. Maybe that seems presumptuous. Maybe it was, but it came out of my love for him. No other reason. So I would talk with him about the Lord when I could. We would email about lots of things, and occasionally I'd share a Bible verse with him. But mostly I prayed for him. For the past 28 years, I asked the Lord to bless him and draw Rush into the kingdom of heaven. And I asked the Lord to bring other strong believers into his life that would be far more credible in Rush's life than little old me. I was not the only one. I met evangelicals all over America who, when they learned that I once worked for him, would tell me, "I love Rush and I'm praying for him every day." Last February, when I heard him share on the air his stunning diagnosis, having terminal stage 4 cancer, I immediately wrote and asked if I could come see him. He immediately wrote back and said yes, he would like that. In the States already, where I would speak at the AIPAC conference and begin a book tour, I rerouted to Palm Beach. But when I got there, he was not doing well. Day after day, I waited in the hotel, and he would write to me and say he wanted to see me but didn't have the strength. He was really struggling. I told him not to worry, I'd wait, no pressure. But in the end, that week, he couldn't see anyone. COVID was now sweeping the planet. The Israeli government told all Israeli citizens to return home immediately or risk the airports being closed. My book tour was canceled, and I had to head back to my family. I never got to see Rush again in person. And I worried that he was going to pass away without knowing for absolute certain that he was going to heaven. That grieved me. But something happened on that trip that changed everything. I learned the greatest possible news, that just the year before, in 2019, Rush had given his life wholly and completely to the Lord Jesus Christ. Maybe he had made a decision to receive Christ by faith when he was much younger and had, like many of us, struggled to walk closely with Christ after that decision. That I cannot say. But I now knew that he was studying the Bible like he had never done before. He was praying like he'd never done before. He was growing spiritually, and it was transforming him. And it wasn't out of desperation. It wasn't simply because he was contemplating his own death. It was because he had truly wrestled through the claims of Jesus for himself and come to the conclusion that Jesus really did die on the cross, rise again, and was the Messiah, the Savior, and the King of the universe. And having placed his faith in Christ's love and forgiveness, he now had a certain definitive hope that he was going to heaven when he died, and peace for every day before that. I was overjoyed. I didn't feel at liberty to say any of this publicly, so I didn't. I told my wife Lynn and my sons, and we rejoiced because we had been praying for him and his family for decades. But then another wonderful thing happened. I began to hear him share about his faith in Christ and newfound hope with the radio audience he loved so dearly and who so loved him. For such a public person, Rush was also intensely private, but he began talking about his faith in Christ, and I knew beyond the shadow of a doubt it was real. Consider what Rush said on his October 19th program, an update on my health. It's a roller coaster. When he shared that he had come to the very hard realization that he was under a death sentence and that time was running out. It's tough to realize that the days where I do not think I'm under a death sentence are over. Now we all are, is the point. We all know that we're going to die at some point. But when you have a terminal disease diagnosis that has a time frame to it, then that puts a different psychological and even physical awareness to it. You know, I wake up every day and thank God that I did. I go to bed every night praying I'm gonna wake up. I don't know how many of you do that, those of you who are not sick, those of you who are not facing something like I and countless other millions are. But it's a blessing when you wake up. It's a stop everything and thank God moment. And every day thus results in me feeling more and more blessed. Hearing from you, knowing that you're out there praying and everything else you're doing, that is a blessing. It's just a series of blessings. And I am grateful to be able to come here to the studio, tell you about it, and really maintain as much normalcy as I can. I know a lot of you out there are going through your own challenges, whether it's cancer or another medical illness or some other life challenge, maybe even in the hospital right now. Someone told me, I think this is good advice, may be helpful. The only thing that any of us are certain is of right now, today. That's why I thank God every morning when I wake up. I thank God that I did. I try to make it the best day I can no matter what. I don't look too far ahead. I certainly don't look too far back. I try to remain committed to the idea what's supposed to happen will happen when it's meant to. I mentioned at the outset of this, the first day I told you, that I have personal relationship with Jesus Christ. It is of immense value, strength, confidence, and that's why I'm able to remain fully committed to the idea that what is supposed to happen will happen when it's meant to. There's some comfort in knowing that some things are not in our hands. There's a lot of fear associated with that too, but there is some comfort. It's helpful. God is it helpful. It's helpful to be able to trust and to believe in a higher plan. So again, let me just thank all of you for your support, your prayers. I send the same to all of you through anything that you are facing. So now the objective here is rounding third, not having to head back to second base and slide in there. Here's to rounding third and heading towards home. That's the objective. That's the goal. can't bear to read the obituaries and mainstream media reports about Rush's passing. They are sadly filled with so much hate and venom. I prefer to be in touch with Rush's family and team and those who loved him and appreciate him for all that he was, strengths and weaknesses included. But I'll tell you this, one of the things I look forward to is seeing my friend Rush in heaven one day. He's not there because of me. Rush is there because Jesus loved him dearly and opened his eyes to the beautiful truth of the gospel. That's that the Lord wants to adopt all of us into his kingdom if we will only say yes. For God so loved the world, Jesus said, that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. John 3:16. The Lord made Rush an offer he couldn't refuse, and Rush had the humility and the wisdom to say yes. I'm so grateful, and I can't wait to see him again.
Thank you for joining us for this week's readings of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American Religion sections. Coming up next is this week's Sunday School Lessons.
Bible Studies for Life for the week of February 21st, 2021. Connecting to Christ's body. Question number one. When has being part of a group really helped you succeed? The point. Spiritual growth calls for regular interaction with and ministry to other believers. The passage. 1 Corinthians 12:12 through 24. The Bible Needs Life. In April 1970, Apollo 13 was headed to the moon when disaster struck. An oxygen tank exploded, forcing NASA to abort the mission. To save power they would need later for re-entry, the astronauts moved from the service module to the lunar module. This created a problem. The lunar module was designed for two people, and there was not enough air for three men to last the trip home. The buildup of carbon dioxide threatened their lives. They would need to replace the CO2 scrubbers to clean the air, but the only spare ones were built for the service module and didn't fit the lunar module. On the ground, NASA's Crew Systems Division put together an improvised scrubber using random parts they knew the astronauts had. The instructions were transmitted, and the astronauts assembled the makeshift scrubber. It worked, and three lives were saved. But no one person could take credit for this. It took a collection of engineers and technicians working together to come up with the solution. Our spiritual growth is the same. We need the support and input from others, and they need ours. 1 Corinthians 12:12 and 13. For as the body is one, and hath many members, and all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit are we all baptized into one body, whether we be Jews or Gentiles, whether we be bond or free, and have been all made to drink into one Spirit. Paul likened the church to the human body. Like a team, the body is comprised of many members, but it still functions as a single body. Paul took care to give this special emphasis. We use different techniques to give something emphasis. Some people use all caps to emphasize a thought in an email. Authors sometimes put a word or phrase in italics to indicate that it is a key term that needs the reader's special attention. Biblical writers use something called synonymous parallelism to emphasize a particular truth. This is a literary device that repeats a phrase using slightly different terminology. If the writer really wanted the thought to stand out, he would also arrange the parallel thoughts in a chasm, a poetic structure that places the parallel thoughts in a crosswise arrangement. In verse 12, Paul used a chasm to give emphasis to a truth about the body of Christ. For as the body is one, crosses over, are one body. All the members of that one body being made, crosses over, and hath many members. Paul's emphasis is clear, and he did not want us to miss it. The human body is a singular, unified body, even though it has many parts. He repeated the thought in slightly different words and structure, arranging his argument to make it pop off the page for his audience. The church, like the human body, has many parts or members. The individual members are unique in their personalities, backgrounds, and spiritual giftedness, but they are all one body. The diversity does not work against unity. In fact, that diversity is functionally necessary. Just like the body works only with the contributions of legs, feet, eyes, heart, lungs, and so forth, it makes no sense to see one member of the church functioning well apart from the whole. Paul reminded the church they were all baptized into a single body. While believers come from different races, cultures, and socio-economic levels, our differences did not threaten the church's wholeness. We are one. Coming from all our diverse backgrounds, we do not become uniform and exactly alike, but we do enter into a single body, Christ's body. In the New Testament, baptism often refers to a person's physical immersion in water. In this passage, though, Paul was not referring to literal water baptism. Instead, he was using the term metaphorically to indicate that the church had been immersed into the Spirit. We have been covered by the Holy Spirit. But Paul did not stop with that word picture. It isn't just that the Spirit covers the church, but the Holy Spirit also is inside the individual members of the church. Believers are all made to drink into one Spirit. God's Holy Spirit makes us one, and He fills us and empowers us to function as one. Question number two. What are the benefits of unity in the church? 1 Corinthians 12, 14 through 18. For the body is not one member, but many. If the foot shall say, "Because I am not the hand, I am not of the body," it is therefore not of the body. And if the ear shall say, "Because I am not the eye, I am not of the body," is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where were the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where were the smelling? But now hath God set the members, every one of them, in the body, as it hath pleased Him. Unity of the body does not imply uninformity among the members. The human body has many members, and all of them are important to its function as a whole. The foot does not resent that it is not a hand. Instead, it serves the whole body by being a foot. The ear is not jealous of the eye, because of the eye sees and it hears. Neither does it question its own significance. Without the ear, the body would have only four senses to operate. Paul made an obvious argument to clarify this point. The whole body is not an eye, and the eye is only valuable in relation to all the other body parts if it functions as an eye. It contributes to the health and function of the body just as other members of the body carry out their specific roles for the sake of the body. Just as each individual body part has its own unique role and function, each member of the congregation serves a role and has individual responsibilities. For the church as a whole to function well, each individual member of the congregation needs to fulfill his or her role and responsibility in a way that is consistent with the spiritual gifts God has bestowed. Paul included a partial listing of spiritual gifts in verses 4 through 10. While serving in a specific role does not carry with it unique responsibilities, and everyone ministers according to his or her spiritual gifts, we do share some responsibilities. For example, every member of the body is to pray for other members, James 5:16, and to give and support the ministry of the church, 1 Corinthians 16:2. And we are all called to share our faith and disciple others, Matthew 28:18-20. Not all of the body's members are visible to the naked eye, and not every member in the church has an out front and highly public role. If we extend Paul's analogy, the results are staggering. For instance, the human body has 11 major organ systems containing at least 78 different organs. Doctors differ on how many organs are classified. We have 206 bones, and our tongues may have as many as 10,000 taste buds. Those taste buds have a number of flavor receptors spread on the surface of the tongue that are designed to detect bitter, sweet, sour, salty, and savory. All these components work together to alert us whether or not what we are eating is healthy to eat. For example, because many toxins taste bitter, the taste buds send a warning signal for us to reject bitter-tasting food. Salty foods contain necessary sodium, and sweet-tasting foods provide instant energy. In each case, the taste buds are gatekeepers to keep needed substances in and harmful substances out. However, those 10,000 taste buds don't function alone. The taste receptors in our mouths need to work in concert with your nose to enable us to experience the myriad of flavors we enjoy. The church, like the human body, is made up of many members that function in different roles and have unique responsibilities. But no one member could function effectively without the rest of the body. Even those serving in prominent or visible roles, like pastors and church leaders, cannot be effective apart from the ministry of the whole church. An effective church has everyone working together for the cause of Christ. Question number 3. What are the dangers of comparing ourselves and our gifting to others in the church? 1 Corinthians 12:19-24. And if they were all one member, where were the body? But now are they many members, yet but one body. And the eye cannot say unto the hand, I have no need of thee, nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. Nay, much more those members of the body, which seem to be more feeble, are necessary. And those members of the body, which we think to be less honorable, upon these we bestow our abundant honor, and our uncomely parts have more abundant comeliness. For our comely parts have no need, but God hath tempered the body together, having given more abundant honor to that part which lacketh. Paul's teaching about unity in diversity was not a hypocritical exercise. The church in Corinth was not healthy. It was rife with division. They quarreled over who their favorite leaders were. 1 Corinthians 1:10-13. They envied one another and were striving against each other. 3:3. They brought lawsuits against one another. 6:1-8. Their self-centeredness was evident even in the way they acted at the Lord's Supper. 11:17-22. This church desperately needed unity. Carnality and division were tearing the Corinthian church apart. In that context, Paul emphasized that every member of the church is necessary and must be treated as an important part of the body. Open division was occurring in the Corinthian church, but in some churches the disunity can be less obvious. For example, it can be tempting for any individual member to value his own role in the church to the point he devalues others' roles. Or people begin to gather with others with whom they share a lot in common, but they exclude those who are not in their clique. Question number 4. What does a healthy church body look like? Diversity in the body is necessary, but diversity should not lead to division. Paul underscored this when he said the eye cannot reject the hand, because it viewed the hand as useless and unnecessary. Neither can the head reject the feet. Every member, according to Paul, is necessary. Some are covered for modesty's sake, but none is unimportant. If you have ever stubbed your little toe on a coffee table, then you know that even smaller, seemingly unimportant members of the body are still connected to the body and profoundly affect the functioning of the whole. No body would exist without the different members. However, if the different members do not fulfill their individual functions in concert with the other members, the body will not be healthy. In a healthy body, the systems all work together, supporting one another. However, when a person suffers from an autoimmune disease, one part of the body begins to produce antibodies that will attack and harm another part. Rheumatoid arthritis, for example, causes the immune system to attack the joints, causing swelling and pain. Untreated, it can cause permanent damage. Systematic lupus, like rheumatoid arthritis, can attack the joints, but it also can affect organs like the kidneys and lungs. In multiple sclerosis, the immune system attacks nerve cells and can lead to blindness and mobility impairment. Unhealthy churches have the equivalent of an autoimmune disease because one group attacks another. In a healthy church, members not only work together, but they value, appreciate, and depend on others to have different roles. The members of the church work hard to practice true Christian fellowship. Such fellowship includes celebrating other people's joys, crying with them in their sorrow, and walking beside them in their pain. And we need that interaction for the sake of our own individual spiritual growth. As a spiritual disciple, fellowship is not as much about the casual conversation that occurs over coffee and donuts, as it is listening deeply and entering into other people's lives. Fellowship is an intentional choice to value others' believers, even those who are vastly different from us, because God desires to use His church with its diverse members to aid your growth in Christ. Question number 5. How can our group help one another recognize and utilize our gifts? Engage. Uniformity requires that everyone be alike. Unity allows diversity as people work together in harmony. Answer the following questions about your own church. What are some ways you are uniquely different from other people in your church? What are some ways your differences complement others in your church? Pray that you might appreciate others' differences just as you want them to accept yours. Live it out. How will you deepen your involvement with other believers and serve them? Talk to someone new. Get to know someone in your church you do not know or do not know well. Make an intentional effort to build a relationship with the person. Restore a relationship. If you are at odds with someone in your church, get together with the person and seek to work the problem out. If you need to confess a wrong attitude or wrong behavior, then do it and seek to restore that relationship. Step out and serve. Use some of your time to immerse yourself in a new culture and serve a people group that is unfamiliar to you. Be part of a mission work that serves the body of Christ in another culture or setting. End of the lesson for the week of February 21, 2021.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Sunday School Lessons. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Military Times, followed by Sports Illustrated at 10. Now airing on the Noon Book Hour, Extraordinary Ordinary People, a memoir of family written and narrated by Condoleezza Rice. Condoleezza Rice has excelled as a diplomat, political scientist, and concert pianist. Her achievements run the gamut from helping to oversee the collapse of communism in Europe and the decline of the Soviet Union, to working to protect the country in the aftermath of 9/11, to becoming only the second woman and the first black woman ever to serve as Secretary of State. In the 50s, Birmingham's black middle class largely succeeded in insulating their children from the most corrosive effects of racism. Condoleezza's father, John, a minister and educator, instilled in her a love of sports and politics. Her mother, a teacher, developed Condoleezza's passion for piano and exposed her to the fine arts. From both, Rice learned the value of faith in the face of hardship and the importance of giving back to the community. Extraordinary Ordinary People, a memoir of family, written and narrated by Condoleezza Rice. Weekdays at noon and 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 47 and clear. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the low 60s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the mid-40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 9 a.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, my name is Rob Johnson, and this is news from Military Times on this Thursday, the 25th of February, 2021. We begin today's broadcast with a sad story. Officials with the Wisconsin Air National Guard over the weekend identified an airman with the 115th Fighter Wing who was one of two people who died February 16th in a civilian aviation crash. Staff Sergeant Remington, Remington, K. Viney, V. Victor, Iney, 26, was killed in the aircraft crash in Janesville, Wisconsin at 9:18 in the morning, February 16th, according to the wing's Facebook page. A local TV station, Channel 2, reported that Viney was one of two people killed Tuesday during a plane crash in Rock County. Authorities identified the other victim as 25-year-old Tanner, T-A-N-N-E-R, Byholm, B-Y-H-O-L-M, of Glidden, Wisconsin. The twin-engine Velocity V-Twin crashed in a river near Janesville shortly after departing from the Southern Wisconsin Regional Airport, according to the National Transportation Safety Board. The Velocity V as in Victor hyphen twin was designed to provide a safe and efficient transportation aircraft, especially for those who fly at night, over mountains, over large bodies of water, serious IFR instrument flight rules, and those who just want the redundancy of a second engine to get them home or an airport in the event of an engine failure, this according to Velocity, its Florida-based manufacturer. The pair were headed to Florida, according to the GazetteExtra.com website. Viney, a Wisconsin resident, began her military journey with the Wisconsin Air National Guard in December of 13. She enlisted as a crew chief assigned to the 115th Fighter Wing, and in 2018 she transitioned to command and control operations, working full-time in the command post. A decorated veteran, Viney deployed overseas on several occasions, according to the wing's Facebook page. In 2015, she deployed to an airbase in Japan, in 2017, an airbase in Korea, and finally stateside to Nellis Air Force Base in 2018 in support of the annual Red Flag exercise. Viney earned her private pilot license and worked as a flight instructor, according to the wing's Facebook page. Staff Sergeant Viney strove to progress and exceed in her life and her career, it states. She earned her baccalaureate degree in business administration and also management marketing, along with an associate's in aircraft maintenance technology, all of that in 2017. She was a graduate of the Sun Prairie High School class of 2012. Remington was passionate about any adventure that life had to offer, according to her obituary. She obtained her pilot's license while still in high school. While in college, she was the captain of the Wisconsin flying team. Additionally, she was a founding member of the Women in Aviation Madison chapter. During her service in the Air Guard, she met the love of her life, fellow service member Kyle Henry, according to her obituary. They shared so much together, including her passion for real estate, flying, and raising her future stepson, Kellen. Above all else, her family was the anchor of her life, and she was so excited for her future with her fiancé, Kyle. Viney was a certified flight instructor who, on her LinkedIn page, wrote she was focused on providing personalized instruction to each of my students, tailoring my teaching to their unique learning style. I work full-time as a flight instructor at Pilotsmith, CAVU, traveling between all three Wisconsin locations, Appleton, Green Bay, and Manitowoc. This was the second fatal aviation mishap involving a 115th fighter wing in the past 2 months. Wisconsin Air National Guard Captain Durwood Hawk Jones, 37, of Albuquerque, New Mexico, lost his life when his F-16 crashed in Michigan's Upper Peninsula December the 8th, according to a post on the wing's Facebook page. Jones joined the Air National Guard in 2011 and graduated from F-16 basic qualification training in 2015. He is a decorated combat veteran, deploying as a part of the United States Pacific Command Theater support package. They went to Japan in 2015, Korea in 17. He deployed again in support of Operation Freedom's Sentinel to Afghanistan in 2019. And news of a second crash, two pilots died when a training aircraft crashed outside of Montgomery, Alabama on Friday evening, according to Air Force officials. Cause of that crash not immediately known. A U.S. Air Force pilot, he was 25, and a pilot from the Japanese Air Self-Defense Force, 24, were on a training flight from Columbus Air Force Base in Mississippi to Tallahassee, Florida, when their T-38 trainer crashed near Danley, D-A-N-L-E-Y, Field in Alabama, according to Colonel Seth Graham, commander of the 14th Flying Training Wing. Both pilots were lieutenants. Graham declined to release their names until next of kin was notified. It is with a heavy heart that I express my condolences. I know that I speak for the entire 14th Flying Training Wing that we are grieving this loss right along with you, Graham said in his Facebook Live video. We are a close-knit team, and the loss of two of our teammates is something that affects us all. All flying operations out of Columbus Air Force Base have been suspended for the foreseeable future. Flights may resume in a few days. Officials have initiated an interim safety board to preserve information and collect data. A flag officer-led board to investigate and compile a report on the incident is still being selected, according to Graham. Graham estimated that the final report will take 30 to 60 days to compile, but it really depends on the complexity of the crash. Marshall Taggart, executive director of the Montgomery Regional Airport, told news outlets that the aircraft crashed in a wooded area near the airport. News outlets showed a number of police cars and fire trucks at the scene. The Columbus Air Force Base is home of the 14th Flying Training Wing of Air Education and Training Command's 19th Air Force. According to the base website, the 14th FTW mission statement is cultivate airmen, create pilots, and connect. The wing's mission is specialized undergraduate pilot training. Evening flying missions are not unusual for Columbus pilots, the colonel said, and this was one of a few training missions taking place on. Turning the page in today's Military Times, this story comes to us from Washington. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, in his first news conference as Pentagon chief, said Friday that progress towards peace in Afghanistan and an end to U.S. military involvement there depends on the Taliban reducing attacks. He said right now, clearly, the violence is too high. He refused, however, to say when the U.S. will decide if it will meet with the May 1st deadline for full troop withdrawal, or if America and its NATO allies will try to renegotiate the peace deal with the Taliban and keep some troops there longer. We are mindful of the looming deadlines, but we want to do this methodically and deliberately, Austin said. But we're focused on making sure that we make the right decisions and we'll go through the process deliberately. Afghanistan is shaping up as a major national security dilemma for Austin and the rest of Biden's fledgling national security team. There is little political appetite to keep U.S. troops in Afghanistan, but pulling them out risks further empowering the Taliban and causing a resurgence in terrorism. Under the deal with the Taliban struck by the Trump administration 1 year ago this month, the United States promised a phased withdrawal of troops so that by May 1, 2021, all foreign troops would be gone. For their part, the Taliban committed to starting peace talks with the Afghan government, ending attacks on American forces, and publicly renouncing all ties to Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups. Speaking to Pentagon reporters, Austin made it clear that the Taliban violence must decrease now and that progress in negotiations with the Afghan government must move forward. Austin is a retired four-star Army general who oversaw U.S. forces in Afghanistan and across the Mideast for 3 years under Obama. He was the head of U.S. Central Command. And with the Biden administration, he's reviewing the options for the next steps in Afghanistan, where U.S. troops have been deployed for 20 years. American forces make up 2,500 of the roughly 10,000 troops training and advising the Afghans, and allies have suggested a willingness to continue that mission if needed. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, said on Friday that her government is willing to keep troops in Afghanistan longer if needed to ensure that the country does not descend into chaos. Withdrawal must not mean that the wrong forces get the upper hand again, she said. Austin, who met with the NATO defense ministers this week, said he assured allies that they will be kept informed as the U.S. considers its options. And he said he told them that the United States will not undertake a hasty or disorderly withdrawal from Afghanistan that puts their forces or the alliance's reputation at risk. In remarks earlier on Friday in a virtual meeting of the Munich Security Conference, Biden gave no indication of his plan for troop levels in Afghanistan. He pledged to support the peace process and to ensure that Afghanistan does not revert to a launching pad for international terrorist attacks. NATO Secretary General Jens, J-E-N-S, Stoltenberg, S-T-O-L-T-E-N-B-E-R-G, said Thursday the Allies are holding out hope for a re-energized peace process that could lead to a ceasefire as a step towards a final political settlement. Short of that, the choices for the U.S. and NATO are difficult. We are faced with very hard and difficult dilemmas, Stoltenberg told reporters after Austin and his fellow NATO defense ministers consulted by video teleconference. Because if we stay beyond May 1st, we risk more violence, we risk more attacks against our own troops, and we risk, of course, also to be part of the continued presence in Afghanistan, that will be difficult. But if we leave, then we also risk that the gains we have made are lost and that Afghanistan again could become a safe haven for international terrorists. In other comments on Friday, Austin said the ongoing Pentagon effort to root out racism and extremism in the military will likely identify just a small number of problems in the force. But quite frankly, they'll probably be a little bit larger than most of us would have guessed, he added. I would just say that small numbers in this case have an outsized impact. Austin also spoke on Thursday with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who is the kingdom's defense chief. He said he delivered the message that Biden has decided the U.S. will no longer support Saudi military operations in Yemen. They heard that message loud and clear, said Austin, who knows many key leaders in the Middle East from his years as the head of the U.S. Central Command. He was there between 13 and 16. In a related story in his remarks to world leaders on Friday, Joe Biden vowed that America remains committed to the foreign military alliances and promised to work closely with international partners in addressing the biggest security threats around the globe. I know the past few years have tested our transatlantic relationship, but the United States is determined to re-engage with you and return back our position of trust and leadership, Biden said in a message to the Munich Security Conference, which was held virtually. America is back, and we're not looking backward. Although Biden never directly mentioned his predecessor, former President Donald Trump, in his speech, the address was clearly focused on repairing relationships with foreign allies, which were strained during Trump's previous 4 years in office. Biden proclaimed that the United States is fully committed to our NATO alliance while also acknowledging Europe's growing investment in the military capabilities that enable our shared defense. Trump had made European governments lower than desired military spending a constant refrain in his presidency, leading to resentment from several alliance members. Biden invoked NATO several times in his speech as a linchpin in global security challenges, including the need to resolve the 19-year military mission in Afghanistan. My administration strongly supports the diplomatic process that is underway to bring an end to this war, he said. We remain committed to ensuring that Afghanistan never again provides a base for terrorist attacks against the United States and our partners. Biden also noted his recent order to halt Trump's plans for a massive drawdown of U.S. forces stationed in Germany, although a broader view of military force posture around the world is ongoing. And Biden vowed that we cannot allow ISIS to reopen and regroup and threaten people in the Middle East and elsewhere, and spoke against Russian, Iranian, and Chinese aggressors. But dealing with those issues, he said, will require more than just American military might. The single best way to revitalize the promise of our future is if we work together with our democratic partners with strength and confidence, he said. I know we'll meet every challenge and outpace every challenger. With just 1 month in office, Biden has not offered specifics on his plans for military and strength, global missions and funding. When he was a candidate, he repeatedly promised to provide enough resources for the Defense Department, but also to invest more in diplomatic efforts and international aid. The White House's proposed fiscal 2022 budget will not be released until April. In our next story, like many civilian grocery stores, some commissaries have been closed because of the severe winter weather in various parts of the country, and customers are seeing some shortages on the shelves because of delayed deliveries to those commissaries. As of Friday afternoon, three commissaries are closed due to the weather: those at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, New York, the Little Rock Air Force Base in Arkansas, and the Memphis Naval Support Activity Center in Tennessee, according to Keith DeBoy, a spokesman for the Defense Commissary Agency. Commissaries in Texas affected by the storm are now open, but 14 commissaries across the East, Central, and West regions have had delayed openings due to the weather conditions and lack of power. The storm has also delayed store deliveries at many locations, he said. The disruption is impacting some products being available to our customers, but we are working with our distributors to get orders to the stores as soon as the road conditions permit, he added. At various times during the week, some bases hit by these severe storms have had to close to all but essential personnel, but the number of services such as child development centers, military clinics, morale, welfare, and recreation programs cut back or completely closed. And from your military magazine, we learn through research that most service members who die by suicide have never been deployed in combat, but that really doesn't show the whole picture. A recent military study found that some combat experiences, especially when coupled with PTSD or depression, are a risk factor in suicide attempts. Combat in general didn't translate to more attempts, the Naval Health Research Center found, but high-intensity situations like ambushes or killing a non-combatant were more linked to suicidal ideation. The study suggests that deployed service members who experience high levels of combat or are exposed to certain types of combat experiences involving unexpected events or those that challenge moral or ethical norms may be at an increased risk of a suicide attempt, either directly or mediated through a mental disorder, according to the report. A decade of research and tracking of military suicides has created a stereotype of service members who die by suicide. They are young, male, white, typically on their first enlistment and with no deployments, going through some type of financial or relationship distress. While that profile is statistically accurate, the NHRC study sought to drill down on combat experience, which is heavily linked with post-traumatic stress, though not the most common factor in suicide attempts. The study looked at the mental health histories of nearly 58,000 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans enrolled between 2001 and 2013, who completed a survey about their experiences every 3 to 5 years after enrollment. Of those, the study found 235 attempted suicide during the reporting period, while another 26 died by suicide. While any experience with combat is generally associated with suicide attempts, according to this report, the researchers removed mental health history from the equation. Essentially, they were looking to see if aspects of combat contributed directly to suicide attempts without the additional factor of a behavioral health diagnosis. It has been well established that combat is associated with increased risk of post-development mental disorders and that mental disorders are associated with increased risk for suicidal behaviors, but only a limited number of studies have examined this indirect association, according to the report. What they found is that killing a civilian, seeing human remains or being ambushed were the experiences most linked to a suicide attempt, whether the service member later sought behavioral health treatment or not. Although it is difficult to know why certain experiences have a stronger association with attempting suicide than other experiences, clinicians may want to consider factors such as the sudden, unexpected nature of certain events and feelings of helplessness or loss of control, in other words, being attacked or ambushed, seeing dead bodies or human remains, compared with more active engagements, such as clearing or searching homes or buildings, the report found. Repetitive exposure to death over time may also be associated with an acquired capability for suicide. Researchers recommended that those treating troops for depression, anxiety, or PTSD ask patients for specifics about their combat experience, looking for particularly dangerous triggers, like having killed a civilian, especially when coupled with a depression diagnosis. And after having reconfirmed that combat experience can indirectly lead to suicide when PTSD is present, these findings emphasize the continued importance of identification and treatment of PTSD and depression, they added. And now an update on COVID-19. Veterans Affairs officials say they are seeing some groups of veterans turn down opportunities to get the COVID-19 vaccine, but it's not necessarily the individuals they expected to have trouble convincing. In communities of color, we're actually exceeding what we are in the white population of America, said Dr. Richard Stone, acting head of the Veterans Health Administration, in testimony before the House Appropriations Committee on Friday. I'm really pleased at how black and Hispanic veterans are accepting the vaccine. For months, health officials have warned that convincing minorities across the country to get the two-shot coronavirus vaccine may pose a special challenge. A recent report by the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, seeking to find out why blacks have been less likely to take the vaccine, found several factors have played a role in stoking the lack of trust. Between mistrust, misinformation, and COVID management that has not always protected the most vulnerable, think inequitable test allocations and vaccination sites, how surprising is it that black communities have lower vaccine acceptance, the study's authors ask. A December Associated Press survey found that only 24% of black Americans and 34% of Hispanic Americans plan to get the vaccine, as opposed to 53% of white Americans. But Stone said that thankfully VA has not seen that predicted problem. Instead, the most reluctant groups in their work so far appear to be rural veterans who may already face significant challenges with health care access and vaccine availability. In one area of New York alone, over 1,000 veterans over age 75 said no thank you, and that really surprised us, he said. Cameron Matthews, Assistant Undersecretary for Health at the VA, said officials have begun pulling together focus groups on the reasons behind the vaccine hesitancy because our rural populations across all age groups are showing differences that we definitely need to address. The department has already administered about 2 million vaccine doses since mid-December. In some locations, nearly all VA staff and high-risk veteran patients have already completed the two-dose regimen. But Stone said getting the vaccines to veterans in rural areas remains a tremendous effort, especially considering that the initial versions of the vaccine require super cool temperatures for storage. This has really been a tough one, he said. We are not doing as well with rural veterans and reaching them as we should be. Members of Congress speculated that the issue with lower vaccine acceptance in rural areas may not have to do with mistrust, but instead with the travel issues involved. Even as mobile veteran centers have helped push VA's totals to more than 300 distribution sites across the country, reaching a vaccine appointment can still be an hours-long drive for many veterans. Many of them are elderly. Stone promised further investigation and improvement in the weeks to come. The department expects to distribute vaccines to nearly 7 million individuals in the coming months, covering nearly every veteran who is an active user of the VA health system. However, lawmakers expressed concerns that other veterans who do not regularly use VA medical care but do not have access to the vaccines elsewhere may be left wanting. Stone said decisions on that will be left to the vaccine availability. Our ability to reach this veteran population is entirely based on the supply, he said. Our desire to get the vaccine into as many veterans as we possibly can remains our true goal. More than 220,000 patients being tracked by VA have contracted coronavirus during the last 11 months, and more than 10,100 have died from the virus. And now an update on a story we reported on last week. The Army still can't say how many soldiers have been kicked out for extremism in recent years, largely because those incidents are filed under the broad category of misconduct charges, according to the service's response to a Freedom of Information Act request. Army officials at the Pentagon did not have data that could shed light on the issue either. Currently, extremism behavior is not identified by a separate code for discharges, said Army spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Gabriel J. Ramirez. As we await further DOD guidance on extremism, we are conducting stand-downs across the force and exploring options on ways to further combat this corrosive issue. The data omission makes it difficult to understand the extent to which extremism is a problem in the ranks, an issue that came to the forefront after at least 22 current or former service members were charged with federal crimes for participating in the Capitol riot in Washington, D.C. last month. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin announced in early February plans for a 60-day stand down across the military to address the issues of extremism among troops. During a press briefing on Friday, he hinted at plans to gather data on extremism, but did not detail what that would entail. "I expect for the numbers to be as small," he said, "but quite frankly, they're probably a little bit larger than most of us would want," Austin said. "I would just say that small numbers in this case can have an outsized impact." The Army has regulations that guard against extremism, and the guidance is punitive, meaning soldiers who violate it can be punished under the Uniform Code of Military Justice and even separated from the service. But the number of administrative separation boards that dealt with extremism can't be looked at separately, according to the Human Resources Command's FOIA office. This information being sought is not tracked or broken down as requested. The discharge information would fall under a separate code that is inclusive of all misconduct charges, reads the command's response to an FOIA request. This command does not have a separation code just for extremist activities. The Army Crime Record Center is fielding a separate FOIA request regarding extremist arrest, but it's not clear whether they would even deal with the bulk of extremism-related cases. Without criminality, Army CID special agents wouldn't necessarily get involved in a case, a CID official said. Adverse actions for extremism can take many forms, including non-judicial punishments under UCM Article 15 or equal opportunity investigations, said retired Army Judge Advocate Lieutenant Colonel Franklin D. Rosenblatt. Other extremism acts could fall under UCM Article 134 for conduct prejudicial to good order and discipline. A soldier who refuses to take down a Confederate flag from a barracks room, for example, could be disciplined for failure to obey an order rather than engaging in extremist activity, said Rosenblatt, who now works for the Mississippi law firm Butler Snow LLP and helps soldiers who face racial discrimination. There is admittedly not always a clear line between sympathizing with causes such as QAnon and violations of military orders, Rosenblatt added. The Army regulation on extremism doesn't list specific organizations that are off limits, but some groups may appear to be under scrutiny, including those included on an infographic which was circulated by the Army's John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and school. The infographic was made by the New York City Police Department's Intelligence Bureau and highlighted extremist imagery used by adherents to QAnon, the Proud Boys, the Three Peer Centers, P-E-R-C-E-N-T-E-R-S, and the Oath Keepers. The Special Warfare Center used the infographic to familiarize leaders with new extremist symbols after one of their medical courses had to change its logo last year because it was nearly identical to imagery used by an anti-government militia. "We are keenly aware that we're on the leading edge of a broader Department of Defense effort, and we're awaiting guidance before we do more than educate and inform our formation," the school's chief of staff, Colonel Matt Gomlat, said last week. The infographic describes KEK flags, boogaloo patches, and variations of Pepe the Frog mimes as examples of imagery co-opted by extremists, in addition to more recognizable swastikas and Norse ruins long used by neo-Nazis. The blurred line between internet culture and traditional extremism may prove difficult for the Pentagon in tackling the problem, especially when it's not always easy to discern what is against a regulation. At approximately 35 minutes past the hour, We learn that the two-star general in charge of the Army War College is under investigation by CID special agents after an allegation of inappropriate touching was made against him, according to the service. Major General Stephen J., last name M-A-R-A-N-I-A-N, suspended February 9th from his position leading the graduate-level education institution for military leaders in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. The allegation against him is unrelated to his current position, said Army spokeswoman Cynthia O. Smith. The Army announced his suspension earlier this month, but the reason for the adverse action was not disclosed until late last week. As this allegation is currently under investigation by special agents from the U.S. Army Criminal Investigative Command, no further information will be released at this time to protect the integrity of the investigative process, Smith said in a statement. These are allegations at this time. He is presumed innocent until a court of law proves otherwise. Task and Purpose reported on Thursday that a protective order was issued in early February against him because of a CID investigation into abusive sexual contact with an Army civilian. Sexual misconduct within the Army has come under further scrutiny following the December 8th release of a report on Fort Hood, Texas, sparked by the death of a specialist, Vanessa Gillen, and the sexual harassment allegations her family brought to the nation's attention. An independent committee found that an environment at Fort Hood allowed sexual assault and harassment to take place. Committee members warned that the problems they found at the post may exist elsewhere in the forces. While the man is under investigation, the number two officer within the Army Corps of Engineers, Major General David C. Hill, will serve as the acting commandant for the Army War College. Marion has been in charge of the institution since July, according to his biography. He previously served as a deputy commanding general for the 2nd Infantry Division at Camp Casey, South Korea, and the commandant of the Army Field Artillery School at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. He was commissioned in 1988 as a field artillery officer after graduating from Bucknell University in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. In our next story, as the Army faces tighter budgets in the coming years, keen observers wonder whether ambitious modernization programs will be curtailed to make way for end strength growth or vice versa. We'd like a much bigger Army, but what I have to do at my level is to say, you know, what can we actually afford? Army Chief of Staff General James McConville said Wednesday during a virtual discussion hosted by the Heritage Foundation. That's why we're taking a hard look at everything. The services study suggests that more soldiers are needed to meet the demand from the combatant commands. In recent months, McConville has expressed concern about the operations tempo already placed on air defense and armored brigades, as well as the force at large. We're going to every single area and taking a look at where we can find the money to modernize the Army. I believe we absolutely must do that, McConville added. At the same time, the end strength we have is what we need to keep, and we've got to make sure that every one of these soldiers that we send into harm's way is trained, so we've got to maintain the readiness also. Army leaders told Congress in March of 2020 that 74% of active duty brigade combat teams were at the highest level of tactical readiness, an improvement over the poor readiness metrics reported in 2018. The active duty Army met its end strength goal last year of 485,000 soldiers. The service is now planning for a goal of 486,000 soldiers in fiscal 2021. Beyond that, we project sustained growth of 1,000 to 1,500 soldiers per year, said Lieutenant Colonel Junal Jeffrey, an Army Personnel Issues spokeswoman. This measured approach focuses on getting the right people with the right skills in the right jobs and is a key part of putting people first. The Army.